Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
Okay, so we're in the middle of the Tower of Bavel, the Migdal Bavel. We took a week off last week, I apologize, but I heard you had a fantastic substitute. So what I'd like to do is get back into the Migdal Bavel. As I mentioned to you many times, this whole class is now a little bit of an experiment for me, in the sense of actually just taking one topic and doing it in depth. So we're going to continue with our experimental approach and do something that I've never really done before, but I think you will find fascinating. So we're off doing the stories. We've been through the story in depth. We raised a whole lot of questions and gave a number of answers at this point to those questions. So there are a number of approaches to the story. And so what I've decided to do at this point, and again, this is all experimental, tell me when or not this is working, is instead of giving you a brief overview of six different approaches to the story, which will leave your head spinning, no doubt, what I decided to do is take one approach, an in-depth approach, and actually learn it together with you inside, which is what your packets are. These packets are the English version of the commentary of Rav Shamshon Rafael Hirsch. As you see, I made sure to cover the photocopy, the cover page, that you'll have that and you won't just think it's a random series of words and pages. This is from Rav Hirsch. Rav Hirsch is a tremendous Jewish thinker. His commentary on Chumash is enormous, both in its size and its breadth and its depth. So my own experience reading it is it's very difficult reading. Generally, any time that we've done anything textually, it's been in Hebrew, and we go back and forth, we read the Hebrew, we translate. Well, we're actually going to do that even though it's in English, just because of the depth of what it is that he's saying. I think you will find it fascinating. I haven't really done this before personally in terms of learning through such a lengthy piece. We're not going to read every paragraph and every word, but the concepts are really pretty profound, and he will tie in so many of the questions that we have raised. I think that you'll all find it fascinating. It'll take us a couple of weeks to go through. We're not going to go through all 10 pages today, but it really is a brilliant piece, and we'll learn it through, and we'll see what it is that we can derive from that. Before we jump into Rav Hirsch, let's just summarize the stories and some of the major problems, since it's been a couple of weeks since we've done it. So the story, just very quickly, you have it in front of you. What I'm going to do is I'm going to try to raise some of the specific questions that I know that Rav Hirsch is going to address, so we'll put that into that context in terms of, again, addressing the questions that we will be dealing with. So just reading it through, the earth was of one language and one speech. One of the major questions that we addressed was, why does the Torah describe the opening of this story in that manner, being of both one language and of one speech? And what is the difference anyway between being of one language and one speech? Now, the Hebrew words that were used in that pasuk was Safa Echas, is for describing one language, Udvarim Achadim, and one speech. We will describe what exactly is Safa Echas. Okay, now it came to pass, they journeyed from the east, they found a valley in the land of Shinar, and they settled there. So we mentioned already that they journeyed from the east, and the multiple meanings of journeying from the east. One of the meanings that we had, which if you recall, was they journeyed not just from the Kedem, from the east, but Mikadmono, from the original one. They journeyed away from Hashem, and we traced this phrase to several other places in Tanakh where we find an individual or a group of individuals moving away from God, both symbolically in their physical move, but more in their emotional, religious, mental state. They are moving away from Him. And the Torah uses the same phrase here of they traveled, Mikedem, they traveled away from the east. They found this valley, and that's where they settled. In verse 3, they then say to one another, let us make bricks, burn them in fire. The bricks then serve them as stone, and the bitumen or the slime serve them as mortar. Like, why do we have this whole, what's the point of that sentence? Let us make bricks. Why is this, we're told a lot of information here, you know, the story is short. What's the relevance necessarily of this? What was their purpose of making bricks in the fire? Then they have a second statement in which they say, let us build a city and a tower with its top in the heavens. Let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be dispersed across the face of the whole earth. The questions that we raised there again were, what does it mean, let us make a name for ourselves? What was their agenda? It seems like the Torah is pointing us to their goal, their agenda. Let us make a name for ourselves. What does that mean, let us make? They just wanted to be rich and famous? They wanted to have their name in the newspaper? What does that mean that they wanted to have a name for themselves? And why were they so concerned lest they be dispersed across the face of the earth? That seems to be their concern, this idea of making a name and let them, that they shouldn't be dispersed. Hashem then comes down to look at the tower which the sons of man built. And Hashem says, look, they're one people, one language, and this is what they do. Nothing shall be withholden from them. We'll discuss that again in depth, the two different ways of reading that pasuk. Let us descend and confuse their language, that they should not understand one another's language. And then he dispersed them from there. They stopped building the city, and therefore it was called Babel, because there Hashem confused the language. And various small little questions which he raised along the way. What Hashem said he was going to do was confuse their language, and then what actually happens is they disperse. He doesn't say that he was going to disperse them. He only said that he was going to confuse their language, and they end up becoming dispersed. They stop building the city. We mentioned, why would they stop building? Really, what they should have stopped building was the tower. The tower seemed to have been more of the problem, and yet the Torah says what they stopped building was the city. And then this, the final verse, that's why it's called Babel. This is where everything was confused. Okay, that's a brief summary of the issues we discussed and many of the questions that we raised, some of which we began to address some issues. We've mentioned Rashi and various other sources who seem to attribute this idea. Somehow this building of a city and a tower was a war against God. On some level, that's what they were doing. And we mentioned the question against on that idea is exactly what were they thinking? Did they really think that they were going to build a tower and somehow wage a war with God? Did they mean that literally? That they would climb the tower with a sword and shield and somehow slay God? Or was there something much more symbolic that, yes, it was a war against God. It does refer to some form of idolatry, as we saw some of the other comments that Rashi made. But we'll have to deal with how to understand that. What were these people thinking? Is that really what they had in mind? Just to go up with a sword and shield and see what they could do? Or is this somehow a meaning of something greater that the tower represented as being a war against God, so to speak? Okay, lastly I'll mention, and Rafersha is going to mention this as well, the Torah, the sages point out that it's missing in this story what they did so bad. I mean, we didn't read the sages to point that out, we pointed that out. We read to the story, and I asked you, on the first day we learned this together, I said, what did they do? And there's nothing in the text. It's missing. It's not here that there's anything so obvious about what this group of people have done that should cause God to come down and say, I can't tolerate this, let's confuse their language and disperse them. It's missing. So the sages pointed that out, that when it came to the flood, the generation of the flood which was wiped out, Torah is very explicit as to what happened. What kind of problems they had, be it in thievery, be it in illicit relationships, it's clear. This was the problem, this was the result. In this story, the generation of the tower, the sages point out it's really missing. So Maimonides, which we already have seen, pointed out that that's because that's not the point. The point was just to give us the context as to how is it possible to end up with so many different languages under such a short amount of time. So the Torah is answering a question that any thinking person would have if they were given this book and they said, here's the history of the world. It started with Adam. And you're reading it now 500,000 years later after Adam, and you say, how did we get from Adam to here? The world is populated of different language. How did it happen? So the Torah put in the story as to how that happened. But the other commentators, not necessarily just simply writing it off as explaining that fact, are also looking for what took place, as Hirsch is going to say. Therefore, we have to search in it deeper to understand, because the Torah leaves it out. The Torah doesn't tell us why it's there. I mean, the Rambam might be true as well, obviously. And even with that, but the Torah doesn't tell us what is it that they did that caused the dispersion. It's not mentioned. So we need to look to find that and understand that. Okay, with all that, let's start with Rav Hirsch. Again, this is a first for me, it's a first for you, so we'll see how it goes as far as reading it together inside. We're going to jump around a little bit, skipping something that we can't read the whole thing, but we will do as best we can. Okay, so it starts on page 204, chapter 11. Now, there are different words in Hebrew. Hirsch was a real linguist. He understood the nuances of language in a brilliant manner, and he is going to regularly use that. You'll see right away in his commentary, obviously, even, of course, what language did Hirsch write in?
German.
Rav Hirsch was a great German leader. He just as a brief biographical sketch, Rav Hirsch was the leading force against the Reform movement. The Reform movement, which was founded in Germany as the enlightened Europe came about, and they were opening up things and all sorts of things. And the Jews, like as in all great movements, many of them jumped on. They wanted to be part of it, but being part of the German Enlightened movement basically meant you couldn't be part of the archaic, old-fashioned ways of Torah Judaism. And Rav Hirsch was the opponent to the Reform movement, the one who took Torah Judaism and explained it using language, explained it using the concepts of the Enlightened German movement to the masses to be able to keep Torah Judaism on the same pedestal as secular culture was, and Reform Judaism was trying to position itself, and he was that champion of that. His writing is beautiful. It's still applicable today in many of the issues that we face in our modern world as well. One of the skills that he had was as a linguist. He just understood the nuance of language, of the Torah, different words that were used and their meanings when the Torah chooses this word over that word in terms of explaining the depth of its concept. And you'll see in the commentary, we have the English version of his translation. He, of course, as was mentioned, wrote in German. And the commentary switches from English to Hebrew because you can't use or refer all in English, because you have to have the original word as he's expressing the nuances of the difference of the word. So it's in there, and we will address that as best we can as we go along. We find in the Torah different words for language. Sometimes we find the word Lashon. Lashon HaKodesh, for example, is how we define the Hebrew tongue, the Hebrew language. Now, what does the word Lashon literally mean?
A tongue.
So sometimes the word that's used to define a language comes from the word Lashon, which comes from the word tongue. And sometimes we have the word Safa. Safa also has a word.
Lips.
Which is lips, exactly. So Rav Hirsch is a kind of scholar who picks up on the nuance. What's the difference? We have two words which are used to define a language. One word comes from lip, and one comes from tongue, which is interesting. They clearly are both focused on the mouth area, because of course it is the mouth which speaks the language. One word to define a language comes from the lip, and one word for language comes from the tongue. Why would there be those two? And which one does the Torah here use in our story of the Tower of Babel when it defines the world as being of one language? Safar, the lip. It doesn't define the individual. They weren't all of one tongue. They were all of one lip. Even though it means language, they both mean language, but the type of language, the word for language that's chosen is the word Safa, which has to do with the lip. Is it clear so far? Even just that is a fascinating little insight, isn't it? That sometimes we use the word tongue for language. They speak a different tongue. We do that in English also, right? We just don't have the word for lip. But we do have the word, in English, we use the word tongue to describe a type of a language. Yeah?
I was going to say, is it possible there's a differential? The tongue might refer to something as an understanding versus the lip referring to something that has to do more with speech?
We're going to come to that distinction, but not here. We will get to that concept in speech, but not here. We'll get there soon, today even. So the verse starts as follows. We have, starting from the beginning of verse 1. Ideally, I would, if I had the time, I would label this, you know, like when your kids come home from in schoolwork, like line 1, line 2, line 3, I would do the whole thing like that, because some lines, we'll have to just figure out where I am, but we'll deal with that. But anyway, so starting with verse 1, right-hand side of the page. We have already seen above, which we're not going to see, that from quite natural causes, the people spread out in different groups, and in consequence acquire different lashonos. Meaning to say, without God coming in at the end of our story and purposely, directively spreading the people out, people will naturally spread out. And when they naturally spread out, will develop different lashonos, different types of language. We see this in our own time. Simply, when you talk about here in Atlanta, You go a couple miles north, south, east, west into the outside surrounding areas, you'll get a little bit of a different dialect, a little bit of a different language, a different nuance. A simple example, nobody in the Northeast ever uses the word y'all. It's just not part of the language. It's not used. So there are many words and phrases like that which you're all familiar with, which the Northerners like to make fun of the Southerners, Southerners like to make fun of the Northerners. They're words and phrases which develop in certain places for various reasons, all part of the same language. We all speak English, but there are nuanced phrases and ways of expressing things which exist in some places. And that's a natural development based on each local culture as they develop. So says Rav Hirsch, the natural consequence is you acquire different lashonos. Now he's using very carefully his word for language. He uses the words of lashon. But these lashonos were not different languages, just different ways of speaking the same language. Meaning, just as the relation is between lashon, meaning the tongue, and safa of the lip, so is that of their product and speech. Meaning, we're going to explain this in a second, they had one lip, but various tongues. I.e., they had one language, only that it was spoken in different dialects. So what he's going to explain is the concept of a lip. Let me read one more sentence, and we'll go back and explain this. Safa, which is a word for language, which literally means lip, really means the border. Not the end where something has to leave off, but where its natural end is. Where it has reached the limit it is to reach, and so comes to its edge. How do you say that, like the border of the water and the sand? Is also al-sfas hayom, on the border of where the sea meets the sand, is a border. Sfas hayom is the same word we use for lip. So as a first, why is the word safa the same? Because it just literally means a border. It's the end of something where it comes to its natural end. The lip is called a safa as being the borderline, the end of the interior of the body. My whole mouth, it ends at, that's the external part of the body. Then just as safa really represents the whole oral cavity, and lashon, the tongue, a single organ which regulates the breath. So what's the relationship between these two words of language, safa and lashon, lip and tongue? Safa, meaning the border, represents the whole of the oral cavity, represents what we would call in English, the mouth. Your tongue represents a single organ, a unit, a part of your mouth.
It's a subset.
Correct. It's a part of it. In other words, we would never use the word tongue to define the general mouth area. We would use the word mouth in English, in Hebrew would be safa, to define the general mouth area. I'm having surgery today. Where are you having surgery? In my mouth. Where in your mouth? I have no idea. It could be anywhere in my mouth, but I would use the English word mouth just to say it's somewhere over there. The word safa in Hebrew has that connotation. The lip, meaning end or border, represents the whole. Tongue is very specific. It's a specific organ within the mouth. So how does that relate to... Yeah?
What about the word pe?
Pe for mouth. Excellent. He does not address that, and I don't know. I don't know. Good question. In other words, what Rai is pointing out...
The mouth is on the border, and the pe is the entire...
Right. In other words, you're pointing out that the English word mouth is really better for pe in Hebrew. In other words, the Hebrew word safa, which is lip, Rav Hirsch's understanding to mean the border of the whole organ and therefore representing the whole organ, whereas the word lashon, tongue, is specific. How would he address the word peh? I don't know. But that's the kind of question I'm sure somewhere in his writings he does, because this is his kind of question. It's like, now we're introducing another word. What's the difference between safa, lashon, and peh? What he's addressing here, I'll tell you why he's not addressing that. He's only addressing why does the Hebrew language have two words for language, lashon and safa. And he's saying they represent, just like safa represents lip, which is the border, which represents the whole of the organ, and lashon, tongue, represents a specific, so too in language, when I say the word safa, I mean the whole of the language. English is a safa. English is a language. We all speak English, whether or not you grew up in the Northeast, whether or not you grew up out West, whether or not you're Southern, whether or not you're English. We all speak English. It's a safa. Lashon is a very specific organ. That would be a dialect of English. There's a Lashon in a Southern Lashon. There's a British Lashon. There's a Northeastern Lashon. It's a dialect, but they're all within the same Safa. Yeah.
We refer to Hebrew as Lashon Kodesh. What would be the...
Good question. Excellent questions. I don't have an answer to that question. That's a good question.
Of Safa has pe in it, because the pe in the hay is in the... you know, I mean, it's...
It's part of that root. Okay, very interesting point.
I mean...
Very good. Very, very good.
And it goes with what your explanation is.
Okay, now how does this relate to our story? So what word does the Torah use here to open up our story? And the whole earth was one Safa. They were one language. Is the Torah telling us they were all of the same dialect, or they were all of the same language? They were all of the same general language, says Rav Hirsch. So therefore, then... Apart from three, four lines in the paragraph. Apart from various dialects, there were still only one language. We may not forget that there was nearly 400 years between the flood and the Haflaga. The Haflaga means a dispersion, meaning our story is 400 years post the flood, during which natural spreading abroad and the resulting modification of speech which results had plenty of time to develop into various dialects, which nevertheless remain Safo Echad. So he's setting up, where are the people? They have already begun to, what's the word I'm looking for, like in biology, where like the embryo begins to, they've begun to differentiate, but they are still one language. So we're at a point in history, which he's going to come back, this is where he's setting up the Torah, setting up when it specifically says Safo Echad, is they were one large language. But the Torah is not saying they all spoke the same dialect, but they were still under the umbrella of one language, which would mean to say this would be the difference of, for example, in today's world, someone who lives in England, and someone who lives in the South, the Deep South, and someone who lives in New York, and someone who lives in California, someone who lives in South Africa, could all be together. They would sound a little funny to each other, and they would have different ways of expressing themselves, but they're all... If you wanted to have a one community, they could all live in one community with their differences because they understand each other. As opposed to if you took an individual from England and an individual from an African country which speaks an African dialect, and you took somebody from France and somebody from Spain, they wouldn't be able to, they couldn't start. They don't speak each other's language. So we are people that have begun to differentiate, but they still speak the same language. Now, what's the second phrase the Torah uses? Udvarim achadim. Now, of one uniform words is, as Rabbi Hirsch would translate it, we have it translated as one speech. What's the difference? Now that we're one language, what does the second phrase mean of Dvarim achadim? Says Rabbi Hirsch as follows. Dvarim, three lines into the next paragraph. We'll start there. Let's start from the top. Dvarim achadim, from the top of the bracket, is not the same as Safo Echos, does not mean the same as one language. Safo Echos, one language, is the phonetic sameness of speech, meaning the words we say are the same. In the English language, the word table is the word table, no matter how you pronounce it or what you think. It all, the word table is table. In Hebrew, for example, it sounds nothing like table. How do you say table in Hebrew? Shulchan, that has no connection to the word table. So Safo Echos means one language, that the sounds connote the same type of meaning. Now, Dvarim Achadim is the sameness of the formation of words and sentences, which is brought about by the spiritual mental agreement in the way that things and their relations are looked at. Now, that's a tough sentence. Dvarim Achadim means the way we use the words are the same, meaning there's a usage of words that might be different in different languages. Now, he has a bunch of different examples here, which he explains later. But what he means here, based on what he writes later, is as follows. I'll just take an example, which he brings a bunch of German examples, which won't mean anything to us. But let's take the word, if a person reaches into their hand and gives something to a poor person who comes to their door, reaches into their pocket, and takes out money and hands it to somebody at their door, what is it that they have done in English? What would we say?
giving?
What do they give?
Charity.
Charity. The word in English we would use is they gave charity. And if we were speaking Hebrew, what would we say they gave?
Tzedakah.
Tzedakah. Now, the meanings of those words are very different. What's the, where did the root of the word charity come from?
Hesed?
No, in English. The English word charity. Where did the English word charity come from?
Share.
So it's very interesting. So if you Google this, the etymology of the word charity, you find out some very fascinating insight. What was the first language that the Torah was translated into?
Greek.
So the Greeks used a word, which I have here, agape. I don't know how to pronounce Greek words correctly. Agape. Something like that.
Agape.
Agape. Now, what does the word agape mean, which was used often throughout the Greek language and Bible, was used as love. That's correct. It means love. The Christian Bibles took that word, and when they translated the word agape into the word of loving kindness, or a full love of mankind, in line with the Christian theology of this idea of brotherly love and loving mankind. So the word charity took on a connoted an idea of love and loving mankind, and in Christian theology, a love of God. And from that, it then became much more specified into the way that we use it today. We don't use the word charity to mean love in a broad sense. We use it to mean in a very narrow sense of giving to somebody in need. But if you think about the connotation, the English word, which is a Christian word really, from the translations of what's come into the English language, what message are we saying with the word I gave charity?
I'm the source.
And I am doing what?
I'm
loving. The message, the idea of the word charity is love. That's what the word, that's the meaning, the neshama, so to speak, of the word, is rooted in an idea of love. Love of mankind, love of God, and therefore you did this. What does the word tzedek mean?
Righteousness.
Righteousness. The connotation of the act of, I don't want to use the word charity because that's what we're trying to distinguish between. Yeah. When I give somebody money and we say, you gave tzedakah, we are not saying you expressed love of mankind. What are we saying? That's right. That's a very different concept. So that we can even use words trying to express, and the language we use has very different meanings. The language, the expression of somebody who gave charity, means they expressed love. The idea of saying you gave tzedakah means you expressed a righteousness of doing the right thing. And there are hundreds, if not thousands, of examples of this in many, many different languages. Sometimes even in various languages where the same word, this is an example where they're actually different words. But they're really the translation of the same word. The Hebrew word tzedakah would almost always be translated as the English word charity. They're interchangeable. Somebody giving a talk on tzedakah will regularly, throughout his talk, go back and forth. If you speak, a Jewish person giving a talk will go back and forth between charity and stuck on charity within the same talk. But it really doesn't mean the same thing at all. Charity means an expression of love, and tzedakah means an expression of righteousness, of doing the right thing. So there's a disagreement in the meaning of the words. Says Rav Hirsch, there was a time where they were safa echas, they spoke the same language, they might have had different dialects, but the umbrella language was the same. Udvorim achadim. And they also spoke the uniform words that the agreed meaning of concepts was the same. They still shared the meaning of what the words were, what the significance of words were. But first we're going to get back to this, is going to bring many examples from the German language, which is going to express what the word judge, for example, will see. What is the meaning of the word judge as it is in German, as it is in Hebrew, how it represents a different concept. The concept of being a judge in German was different than what we're conceptually trying to do in the term in Hebrew. just like the concept of giving money to somebody in the Christian theology, the word that's developed is an expression of something different than the same act trying to be described in Hebrew is something different. And the setup of the time of the Tower of Babel was such where not only did they speak the same language, but the words that they used had the same spiritual meanings, is Refersh's language, where they were at that time. So far, so good? This is just a setup of the context. The Torah in this first pasuk is simply giving us the context of where the story is going to take place. And that says, Rav Hirsch, we'll read that last line on the bottom of page 2 if I get your question in a second. So Rav Hirsch says, all this is designed by Dovar, so that the whole human race was still harmoniously in unison, for good and for bad, both organically and mentally. Meaning, the word, the language, the physical sounds of their language was the same, and the mental meaning of what those sounds meant, they were all still in unison. So that the setup, the context of the story, was a people who were unified. They were unified in that they shared meaning. They shared that the concept of reaching into your pocket to give somebody money, whereas today, it means different things. Does it mean righteousness or does it mean love? They all still agreed upon the spiritual concepts that existed in the world. The acts represented the same things, and that was the context of where our story is going to take place. Yeah?
So, in Torah interpretations, do we frequently experience very similar differentials depending upon who's giving the interpretation?
I'm not sure exactly what you mean by that, but I think the answer to that is yes. Tell me if this is what you mean. I've mentioned, and I think in this class many times, that when, if you're ever approached by some Christian, what's the word I'm blanking on? Yes, thank you. And they say, or just anyone says, do you believe in heaven? Do you believe in hell? Do you believe in the Bible? So the answer to that is yes, but not what you're thinking. In which, that was actually an even better example than charity, in which you could say the word heaven. So when a Christian thinks of the word heaven or hell, I don't know what they have in mind. I haven't been indoctrinated with their theology. But I can guarantee whatever they're thinking it means is not what we think it means. So that's an example of Dvarim Achadim in the sense of the same word. So the word is the Safa is the same. Heaven and hell sound the same. And they have the same general meaning. But what does it actually mean is very different. And that's an example where we're not Dvarim Achadim, we are not of the same words, because it means mentally, socially, spiritually, very different concepts.
My question, it really pertains more to that which is internal rather than an external.
Internally also we can have it. In other words, if Rav is giving a shir and he's, it's always important. The words, in other words, we could speak forever just about the concepts of language and of words, and it's such a fascinating concept. I often, this is, again, I'm not touching, what you're saying is correct. When I am at a table and I gave the drasha on Shabbos morning, and someone at the table, some people usually are there and some people aren't there. So I often, even though my wife does not like it when I do this, but if the person's comfortable, I ask the person who was there, when, someone will ask, what'd you say today? So say, instead of me saying it, I'd love it if you would say it. They usually don't. Depending on who it is, they're comfortable doing so. Because I like to hear what they heard. I know the words that I said, and the words mean different things to them, and they actually get a nuanced difference. Sometimes it's not so nuanced in terms of a different message, and that's because the words we use are so they're so personal to us in terms of what it means and how we use them, that very often messages are different. And I agree with you totally, even internally. If you hear a shir from a Rav who's saying something, sometimes it's pretty clear. Sometimes, he's saying things, and he thinks he knows what he's saying, and he does, but you have a different understanding of what that word is used in the context, and you sometimes get a little different message because of that. But one of them, it's a very critical point to understand the way that the word is being used in defining terms and concepts. Olam Haba is a great example. What in the world does Olam Haba mean? We use that word all the time. What does it mean? The Rishonim, the early commentators, argue whether or not it means the place where our souls go after we die until we're resuscitated and brought back to life. Doesn't mean that period when we're living again, that's Olam Haba, when we're alive. Doesn't mean after that period when the soul lives, which period of world history will that refer to, and what goes on? So we could say that word and we all have a general understanding of what it means. It means something good after we die. But what it literally means, there are many examples of that, yeah. But I'm answering your question, and agreeing with you that yes, language is very critical in understanding. Yeah.
We went through, as a people, went through a period like this. The fact that you have machlokas in the, Hillel and Shammai, there was a time where there was no machlokas, and so there was this understanding. And the fact that that has now come in, so now, similar concepts, there are now different opinions.
Yeah.
Also, I have a question. What is the difference between a shofet and a dayan?
Okay, so he's going to touch on that a little bit. Mm-hmm. He's going to talk about a shofet. He's going to talk about a shofet. So when we'll get there.
Okay.
He's going to bring shofet in when he contrasts the German concept of a judge and what the root of the word judge, what's the function of a judge. And this is a fascinating study, which, I mean, his words are just so ring so true and so brilliant in terms of when you see in English, what's the function of a judge, an English American judge? What is his function? And he derives that in the German from what's the root of the word judge? What is his job? To determine right from wrong? Is his job to place things in the right place? To administer like, what is the function of the judge? You can tell from the derivation of where did the word come from. Mm. And where did the word shofet, what's the root of the word shofat, and what's that function in terms of what the Torah's perspective of what's the primary function of a judge. And you learn so much about a language and a people and a culture based on how those kinds of words developed and the different meanings. But we'll get to that.
I'm sorry. Just want to say, this thing about charity and tzedakah, it really rings true when you have someone come to your house to get a check, and you give them the check, and they say, "Tiskel the mitzvahs," instead of saying, "Thank you." Okay, so it's, Tiskel the mitzvahs is you're really just doing the right thing, you should get married for doing a mitzvah.
Right.
Thank you is that you've kind of done a charitable act, and it depends on who comes to your house.
Right. Okay, we got to do. I wasn't sure how long this is going to take, but I find this just this is fascinating. It will take a while, but I think it's worthwhile. Again, this is experimental, so I'm happy to take your comments offline if you say it's either working or not working. Let's do another pasuk. Let's go. Let's keep moving. Okay, the background of the pasuk is as follows: Vayhi ben Nasa mikedem, it came to us as they journeyed from the east. Now, the Rav Hirsch again, as the linguist, is going to pick up on the word that the Torah uses for their journey. They move to the east. And what word does the Torah use to describe their journey in Hebrew? Bin Nas'am. Noseya. Noseya means to travel. And they travel, to the east, or from the east, I should say. Now, Rav Hirsch picks up on really that. I saw this for the first time when I was preparing this, and this is just so brilliant. The word Nasa, with an ayin, means to travel. It's very closely related to the word which we use all the time, especially in Hanukkah time. Nes. The word nes. The word nes, which means a miracle. It also means a banner or a flag, a staff of some sort. And the root of that, the three letter shoresh root of the word a miracle or banner would be nasa nun samach he, as opposed to the word to journey, nun samach ayin. So the only difference between the word to journey and the word to be tested is that last letter, is it an ayin or a hey? But otherwise it's very closely related. Says Rav Hirsch, brilliant insight. Read this first paragraph, verse 2 on page 205. Nasa, meaning to travel, related to these other words he quotes, means to lift something from the place where it is. You pick it up and you move it. The word nasa with a hey means to place somebody on a higher standpoint than that which he occupies, so as to test him whether he can stand there. For that is what every test is. What is a test? It's which God takes us and puts us somewhere new and says, handle this. You were here. Things have been going just fine. Now I am going to move you elsewhere by changing the circumstances of your life, giving you an ordeal that you now have to struggle with, and I therefore move your position, putting you on a pedestal, so to speak, in order to see how you handle, not for God to see, but really for us to see, but that's a whole other talk, how we handle our new position. That's nace, that's test, with a, I keep saying miracle, it's also miracles, it's related to that, but a whole separate discussion. A nace also means a nisayon, also its primary use, one of its primary uses is an ordeal or a test. So a nasa, now with an ayin, means a voluntary moving away from the place one occupies. Meaning, when I travel, what am I doing? I am voluntarily moving away from the place that I occupy. When I am tested, what's happening, I'm being involuntarily moved from the place that I occupy. So that the word test and journey are very closely related in the Hebrew language. They share the same two first letters, the Nun Samach. When I'm involuntarily moved, where God moves me and puts me in a different place because He's testing me, that's Nisa with a Hey. When I voluntarily move from the place I occupy, then it's Nun Samach Ayin, I am moving away. What's the difference, aside from the obvious difference of who's doing the action? When I'm being involuntarily moved, where do I want to be? Right? I like it where I am. I like it in my comfort zone. I want to stay there. And God is saying, it's time to grow. It's time to move. It's time to change. Nisa, He pushes you with a hay, and therefore gives you a test involuntarily moving you somewhere. When you voluntarily move, where do you want to be? Away from the place you started. So that they have very different connotations. When I journey from somewhere, I am moving away from the place I was. I don't want to be where I was. I journey away from it. When I'm tested, I really want to be back there, and God is saying to me, it's time to move forward. What are the people of our story doing? What word is used for their moving? They were one language using the same mental and spiritual connotations of their words. And what do they do? They're nasa. They voluntarily travel away. Mikedem. Says Rav Hirsch. Now, we just started discussing this. This is on a deeper level. Mikedem doesn't just mean from the east, but we said it also means from God. So what is the connotation when you put those two words together? Not just that they went or they moved, but that they traveled using the language of Nasa. They traveled or journeyed from the east. That's a connotation of they voluntarily said, we want to move away from that to something else. That was God. We are voluntarily picking ourselves up and moving farther. Says Rav Hirsch, I'm starting at the seven lines down at the end of the line. It is remarkable. It is remarkable, says Rav Hirsch, that there, where the earthly sun rises, meaning in the east, the spiritual origin of the human race lies. It's no coincidence, he says, that where they're traveling away from, from the east. What was in the east? Noah, that's where everybody was. The spiritual origin of man is now developing in the east, which, as Rav Hirsch points out, no coincidence that the sun rises in the east. The older generation remained there. The younger generation no longer felt at ease there. This group of people doesn't want to be part of the east, that which was before, that which was already in existence. They felt themselves able to fly on their own wings, went forth, as the sages put it, Mikadmono shel olam. They went away from the one who created the world, the one who pre-existed the world. They traveled specifically away from God. The old leaders of education, like Shem, maybe even Noach, remained in the east, were there, where the original beginning and foundation of development of mankind has been. And it doesn't say Vayis'u, right? Many times when the Jewish people travel in the desert, it's Vayis'a. It means just to travel. That's not the word that's used here. It doesn't say Vayis'u, I'm sorry, it doesn't say Vayis'u, Vayim'tzu, that they traveled and they found, which would imply that they were traveling in order as an introduction to finding, but binasa, meaning they were on their journey away from their homeland, getting away was their object. Now this is a language we have to appreciate the Hebrew for this particular point he's making. It says, Vayehi binasa'am mikadim, and it was in their journey from the east. Meaning, sometimes a person goes on a trip because they need to get to a certain destination. So it says, Vayisu, so I travel to get there. Here, the language that the Torah uses isn't that they had a destination and they needed to travel to get there, but that the travel was their goal. They just needed to get away from where they were. Right? We deal with this all the time. You know, high schoolers or college kids. So, like, where are you moving? Like, I don't know. Away from home. I'm just going away from home. So it's not so much that I have, like, big city dreams. I grew up in Atlanta, and I dream of New York. Alright, so then when you get on the plane, it's because you need to go to New York. I don't know where I'm going to end up. I just know that I need to go away. Says Rav Hirsch, that's what these people were doing. It wasn't that they were looking for something. They had a goal that they needed to get to. It's that they needed to get away from what was. And what was, that's where God was, that's where the older generation was, that's where Noach, Shem, the origins of new mankind, that's where they needed to go from.
Telepathic conversation.
Yeah, I know. You know, I don't understand that stuff. So.
You're way ahead.
They sought something better. More land, more attractive. So they were just journeying. Then they found a plain in the land of Shinar. And then you read the pasuk, right? It came to pass when they journeyed from the east, they found a valley in the land of Shinar.
This is plain, mm-hmm. Valley.
What's that?
This is plain.
Oh, valley. Yeah.
To me, those are a little
bika.
Devoid of mountains and trees.
Yeah, well, he's going to talk a lot about this, that he translates it as a plane. So I'm hoping he'll actually give us his root, which he's not actually going to do, I see. Well, he'll in a second. Let's go, hold on to that second. This was the territory where the first Gibor Tzayid Lefnei Hashem. Now, the Gibor Tzayid, if you remember, was the strong one, the strong hunter, in the before Hashem was a reference to Nimrod, from the last time that we studied together, where the person of Nimrod fits into this story. So, he began his reign. Nimrod begins in this plain, this land of Shinar. And that's where they found where they wanted to be. In this land, they found a plain without mountains, without forests. There it was free. There they settled. So, Rav Hirsch sees in the word bika, he translates as like a gap or a cleft. Which, our original translation was more of a valley, but what our first thing is, its principal point is that it was missing. It was empty. It didn't have anything. It didn't have forests. It didn't have trees. It was just this open area. And they, in their journey away from what was, found this open area, and that's where they wanted to settle. He's going to talk much more about what the significance of it being an open, unsettled area, no forest, no nothing, just a desolate type of area. From there, that's where they wanted to settle. Okay, let's do a little more. Yeah? Okay. Now, what happens when they get there? Well, so we have this people, they're still speaking a common language, maybe different dialects, but a common language, and the meaning of their dialect is this, they share the same value system so that the words are the same. Their words for, in our examples, heaven and hell, their words for giving somebody something else, they all have the same meaning. They haven't yet come to these different understandings of culture and values, and they all share that, but they all want to get away. This group that's traveling, they want to get away from what was. They want to get away from what was already established. They want to get away from Noach and from Shem and from those who have established the new mankind back east, away from God. So they travel and they find a bikar. They find this plain, this unsettled area. No mountains, no forests. Vayomru ish el re'ehu. And every man said one to his friend, Hava nilvana levanim, let us make bricks and burn whatever there is for a fire. Now, there are two parts to this, which we'll only have time for, I see, the first half of this today. And that is the language of Ish El Re'ehu. Now, there are many different ways the Torah describes one person saying something to someone else. Sometimes it says, Vayomer Ish El Achiv. One man said to literally his brother. Now, ish el achiv, when that's used in the Torah, does not literally mean a brother, but the word achiv is therefore being used for, another human being, a brother in race more than anything else, a person says to one another. And sometimes we find this language of ish el re'ehu. Where are some other classic examples where we have the word re'ehu? It's the most famous. When the Torah says that you have to love your fellow man like yourself, what word does the Torah use for that? L'reyecha. So the word reya, which we're now going to have to translate as friend, colleague, but it's a specific usage of that. In Sheva Brachos, we also use an interesting word. What word do you use in Sheva Brachos when we describe the joy of the Chasan and Kala that they should have the same love as Adam and Chava had in Gan Eden? And what word do we use to describe Adam and Chava in Gan Eden? Shnehem Reim Ahuvim. That same word of Reim Ahuvim, of friends, well, I'm using that word very loosely right now, loving friends in Gan Eden Mikadem. I'm forgetting the exact language, but Reim Ahuvim. So what's the connotation of the word Reya? Specifically, if you have to L'Reyacha Kamocha, Reim Ahuvim in Gan Eden, and here we have one man saying L'Reyacha, says Rav Hirsch. Re'ehu or Re'u also comes from the word Lir Ost Son, a very fascinating double usage. How do we say to graze cattle? What is a shepherd called?
Roe.
A roe. Isn't it interesting that a shepherd is called a roe, and when we want to define how you should be nice to your friend, we call him a Reya, you have to L'Reyacha Kamocha, to be a... Now the reason why a shepherd is called a Roe is because his sheep are being, Roim, are grazing. So the word to graze, the noun of that, the one who causes them to graze, is called a Roe, a shepherd. What is the connection between grazing, animals grazing in a field, going out to pasture, and being a friend? The insights of Rav Hirsch are like I knew that. I knew both of those points. I never stopped to think about how funny it is that we call v'yahavta l'reyecha kamocha the same word as a shepherd or to graze. What's the connection? Says Rav Hirsch, brilliance. Next time you're at Sheva Brachos with me and you hear me say this as my Zvar Torah, and you'll say, I remember the first time he saw this and he said this over. Says Rav Hirsch, Re'u of cattle, grazing of cattle, to graze, or to seek that which is congenial of the pasturage, meaning to yield that which is congenial. What does that mean? Says Rav Hirsch, this is the relation in which every man should stand towards every other man. Each should offer himself as pasturage to the other. Each should find his congenial grazing ground in the other. They are mutually to complement, nourish, and care for each other. When you are a friend, you are the pasture for the object who you are a friend with. I am a cattle. I graze in the field. The field presents itself. I am pasturing in the field, meaning I am gaining my nourishment, that which I need, from the field that I pasture in. As a friend, we are ro'im to each other, we are grazing in each other, meaning each one of us serves as the fertile ground from which the other will gain its nourishment. Mutually doing that to each other. When it's one way, then you end up with a problem. Then one is always depleting the other, but it's not going the other way around. But when it's true ro'im, true friends, then it's a mutual pasturing, each one providing the other with what they need for their sustenance and their nourishment. And therefore, v'yahavta l'reyecha kamocha, love your neighbor like yourself. In Sheva Brachos, when a couple gets married, we say, may they be filled with the same love as the reyim ahuvim, as the two love, those two in love in Gan Eden, Adam and Chava, who had that mutual relationship of providing a pasture for each other in Gan Eden. And we use that term here, meaning that they wanted to be able to create something in which they would be able to mutually give something to each other. Continues Refersh. Hava, what do they say to each other? Come, let us build bricks. Now, Hava, says Rav Hirsch, is the commanding imperative, Yahav. Yahav is related to the word of give. Many of you familiar, I'm sure, with... I'm running out of time. There's just so much here. This is so rich.
Mm-hmm.
What is the root of the word ohev? What does the word ohev mean in Hebrew?
Love.
Love. What's the root? Give. Yahav. Hav means to give. So whereas... we were talking about the word giving in Christian theology in terms of like charity, but in Hebrew, in Torah thought, love is giving. When you give, that's how you define love. Rav Dessler has a whole long piece as to which one comes first. Do you love the things you give to, or do you give to the things you love to? It's a very fascinating question. Which one comes first? And he comes to the conclusion that clearly you love the things you give to. If you want to love someone, start giving. You give, you give, you give. You'll begin to love the object of that which you give to. That's a whole other talk for another time. Hava come, says Rav Hirsch, is rooted in the word of give. So meaning what they're saying is when you put these two words together, hav, to areya, indeed you are saying, give yourself here, lend your strength, and when it is one reya speaking to another, it implies, and then I will do the same. If I say to you, hava, I'm saying, come, give of yourself, do something. But I'm not saying, do it and do it alone, like I'm commanding you above you. I'm saying, hava, come, let's do something. You give of yourself for the project, but I'm a reya. I'm saying it, lareya, and I will then do the same, in the same way as we will have this this relationship, this mutual relationship of being out to pasture. What I want you to begin to partake of, when I say, hava, come, let's do something, is, and then I will do the same. Hence, at once, the plural nilvana of let us build, or let us see what we can do together. Let's stop it there. Let us see what we can do together. Let's stop with that first phrase. Vayomru isha re'eyu hava nilvana levenim. When one man said to another, come, let us build bricks, what they are saying is, in the relationship of ish li re'eyu, we're going to have a mutual relationship, and hava, come, I want you to give something to this project, and I will do the same as we begin to endeavor on this project. We ran out of time, but we got lots to do. Okay, Rav Hirsch is brilliant. It is, I'm like, as I'm preparing this, falling in love with his commentary, and I see a class coming in the future of the writings of Rav Hirsch. But let's just focus on this one little topic right now. But that's what we did. We did what? Two verses and a line.
And there are 19 pages.
Yeah. We got a lot to do. But it's brilliant. It really is. Okay, so he's setting up so far, just setting up the equation, where they were up to in terms of their language development and the significance of that in the sense of still sharing ideas. They shared meaning of the language. They shared the culture of the language. They shared the values of the language. They traveled away from God, away from society, away from their teachers, Noach and Shem, and they said, come, let's together in a mutually beneficial relationship, give of yourself to this, hava, come give, and I will do the same, and then let us see what it is that they produce. Okay, hang on to the edges of your seats till next week, and we will continue.